35 years ago this week, Susan Hendricks and her three children were brutally murdered in their Bloomington home.
These stories tell a lot about human nature. I mean, I think this book is as good as any in proving that sometimes truth is a lot more interesting than fiction.
Journalist Steve Vogel joins us to talk about his New York Times best-selling book, Reasonable Doubt, and what we know about the crime 3 decades later. Plus, there's still a big college graduation gap between African-American and Latino students and their white counterparts. So more than 24 Illinois colleges have banded together to try to address this problem. But first, how can all the cows we raise for meat help rather than hurt our environment?
We've been talking with McDonald's for a number of years about the idea that this type of grazing could give them a lot of benefits, could turn their main product, the hamburger, into a health food, could help their main product's production help mitigate climate change.
That's Peter Bick. He joins us. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and it's election day. But don't worry, we're not talking politics, at least not while the polls are open. As is our practice, we are not discussing it. After the polls close tonight, that's another story. But if you need help or resources with voting today, please check out our website, 21stshow.org. And this hour, we've got an entire non-political show for you. Coming up, it's been 35 years since the Hendricks family murders rocked Central Illinois. We'll revisit the story with Bloomington journalist Steve Vogel and what one group is doing to work with Illinois schools to help graduate more Black and Latino college students. But first, we've all heard about how much cattle is a source of greenhouse gas emissions. Maybe you stopped eating beef or at least cut back because of its environmental impact. Well, it stands to reason that this concerns some of our biggest beef consumers. Think about the fast food giant McDonald's. It's investing in new research to find out better ways to raise cattle.
You know, these plants are just almost going nuts, so to speak, with photosynthetic activity once we take the cattle off. And that is allowing these plants, as they're rapidly regrowing, to capture carbon out of the air, you know, and put it back into the soil.
That's a clip from the short film Soil Carbon Cowboys. It features a few cattle ranchers across the U.S. and Canada who are changing the way their cattle graze. And the film's going to be shown tomorrow at McDonald's headquarters right here in Illinois. It showcases some of the initial findings of millions of dollars of research McDonald's has put into this and looks at how changing the way cattle graze can not just cut carbon emissions, but reduce, for example, the use of pesticides. A team of 16 scientists and farmers from more than half a dozen universities, including the University of Illinois, are working on this project. We had a chance to speak with two of the men involved in this $4.7 million research project earlier. Peter Bick is with us, as well as Jonathan Lundgren. Peter is the documentary filmmaker and director-producer behind Soil Carbon Cowboys. He also teaches sustainability journalism at Arizona State University. Jonathan Lundgren is an entomologist who is the founder of the Ecdysis Foundation. Jonathan, Peter, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Peter, when I first met you and you started telling me about this project, you said something to me that really stuck with me. You said it's not about the cattle, it's about the soil. What did you mean by that?
Well, the soil is the foundation for all life. And the way that grazing animals went across North America before the Europeans got here was the big herds of bison. The way those bison moved across the country created the best soils the earth has ever seen, especially here in Illinois. And that's what we're looking at. How do we replicate the way those bison moved across the Great Plains with the way we graze our cattle? Right now, the conventional way of grazing cattle is pretty much the opposite of that. We don't let them herd. We keep them on the same big area for a long period of time. But if you bunch all those cattle up into a herd and you move them in small paddocks frequently across your land, you can replicate the way the Great Plains were built.
Peter, can you remind us what cattle grazing has to do with carbon emissions and what the connection is with traditional cattle grazing?
Sure. Basically, it comes down to the soil. On the most part, the way our soils are being treated across the U.S. and across the world, the soils are actually expiring carbon. They're letting carbon go. But healthy soils draw down carbon through the plants, through photosynthesis. So whenever you see a field that doesn't have any plants growing on it, you're seeing something very, very dangerous. And it's not the way nature wants to be. Nature wants lots of different types of plants growing on that land. And lots of different types of plants bringing down CO2 feed lots of different types of microbes in the soil. When you have that biodiversity above and below ground, you have a system that's robust that's actually drawing down carbon from the atmosphere. And to Jonathan's work, you get a lot of different plants and a lot of soil microbes, you get a whole lot of different bugs. And when you get a whole lot of different bugs, you get resilience.
So let's hear a little bit from two of the farmers and soil carbon cowboys about how they've changed their fields.
Okay, these are sow thistles. They're a weed. But if you eat them when they're just flowering or in the bud, early bud stage, they're higher protein than what the alfalfa is.
My philosophy now is this. If livestock eat it and it provides nutrition to those livestock, it's not a weed, it's a forage. We're saving money. You know, we're not having to buy a herbicide. We're not having to employ machinery, you know, tractors and equipment to put it out as well.
That's a clip from Soil Carbon Cowboys. The short doc is going to be screened tomorrow at McDonald's headquarters right here in Illinois. We're talking to two of the guys behind the doc and this $4.7 million research project. By the way, you can also watch this. If you just go to soilcarboncowboys.com, you can watch this film that's 12 minutes. Jonathan Lundgren is with us as we're talking to him about his work in this. So, Jonathan, we just heard the farmers talk about how they're not using pesticides anymore. How does that make a difference when we're thinking about how that changes bugs in the soil and the environment?
Well, we often think about biodiversity just from a very pest-centric point of view, right? What is the disease? What is the insect pest? What is the weed that we're trying to kill? But when we have that mentality, we forget biodiversity is just the number of species that are out there. And for every one pest insect, I mean, entomologists estimate that there's, you know, 1,700 species on this planet. For every one species of pest, these 1,700 other species are doing things. We can't live without them. And so our decisions end up affecting this really greater community that society relies on, whether we know it or not.
When you look at grasslands, they support pollinating insects. And all those pollinating insects, when they're not pollinating the crops that we've just planted or that are flowering, they need to go someplace healthy to live. So the grasslands in the Midwest U.S. and the Great Plains and all that area, we're losing more acreage of grasslands in this part of the country than we're losing acres of Amazon forest. And so when we think of grasslands and grazing animals, they're part of an ecosystem that's much, much greater than just beef production. If you want to have healthy vegetables being produced, you need healthy soil, and you need those animals to get that soil healthy. So even if you're vegan, which a lot of my friends are, you still need the animal impact to get your soils healthy to produce the vegetables and the fruits that you want, and you need those grasslands to be the home to this huge, huge amount of insects that Jonathan works on. And when we kill one insect, we don't just kill one. Those pesticides don't have a spectrum of one. They kill them all. And so the idea of creating an area where all those insects get to live because we have all these different plants growing, that's the idea. And it comes down to nature. It comes down to letting nature have a seat at the table.
Fostering life in our farmland, you know. And that's what one of the ranchers involved in the project, his catchphrase is he's getting up in the morning, and he doesn't think about what he has to kill in the morning. He thinks about what he gets to grow and the life that he gets to promote on his farm. And changing that mentality, man, is so empowering. It is so empowering for these folks. And from the scientific perspective, too. The potential here, everybody wins in this situation. The ranchers are totally leading the science on this issue. And so the scientists on this team are learning just as quick as we can what these ranchers are able to understand just through their intuition and observation of their operations.
Before we get to more about what you're learning, Peter, how did you find these ranchers? How did you find ranchers, and how did you get them involved in this project, folks who were willing to change the way they were doing things?
Well, Bill Curtis narrated my film Carbon Nation. Bill Curtis had
another great Illinois connection there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he had a beef company, and Alan Williams was his consultant. So Alan is the guy that we're hearing mostly from on these clips. So Alan Williams is one of the innovators of both AMP grazing, adaptive multi-paddock grazing, and in teaching people about it. So when I met Alan, I then started meeting a lot of scientists, including Jonathan. And this team of scientists got together because they were all really interested in this type of grazing. And they had their specialties. John's measuring and studying the bugs above and below ground. We have other folks studying the soil carbon content or the forage production. And so all these pieces of the puzzle came together, and that's how the team formed. And then it was through Alan and our network of where we started finding the farmers. And on this research that we're doing, it's in the southeast U.S., it's the adaptive multi-paddock farmers. They had to have a good relationship with their neighbor because we're studying across the fence line. We want to study both types of systems. So probably about 2% of American ranchers and farmers do this type of multi-paddock grazing, regenerative grazing. The other 98-99% of folks are doing the continuous grazing. And so we're measuring all of that right across the fence line. And so the project has been years in the making, and McDonald's came on board with a $4.5 million match just about 2 years ago. It took us about a year to find the money to match that, and we've been out in the field. I think Jonathan's team was out in early May, and we've been working all summer.
How did you get McDonald's to fund this?
We asked, and we had been talking with McDonald's for a number of years about the idea that this type of grazing could give them a lot of benefits, could turn their main product, the hamburger, into a health food, could help their main product's production, help mitigate climate change, because if you're bringing down a lot of carbon, you're regenerating a lot of soils. It's a very positive thing. They've been going through their research internally, and then they were ready to pull the trigger about when we were ready with our proposal. So it's good timing and good aligned goals. McDonald's sounds just as happy about this as we are, which is really cool. I'm in McDonald's right now, and I just had a meeting that blew my mind. It's how do we go faster? How do we get more farmers to be doing this? Because that IPCC report that just came out, there was one paragraph in 180 pages about soil and carbon. And so there's so little science on this stuff. And Jonathan, being one of our key scientists and pushing this science, we need to measure what these farmers are doing, because what they're doing looks to be phenomenal. And we need to have that data so we can start changing the minds of the people who make up the IPCC and who run NGOs, because a lot of people just think we should eat less meat or no meat. And personally, I don't see how we regenerate our severely degraded soils without animal impact, without these herding animals. I don't know how we get to a healthier ag system, period.
Jonathan, to the bug side of this, because that's what you're doing. So when we heard that little clip of the guys planting all of these things that we used to think of as weeds, how does that change an ecosystem when they're just allowing things that were there naturally? He was talking about sour thistles, all these other things. I think sunflowers, right, that the cattle are eating. How does that change an ecosystem?
It changes the biodiversity. It changes the critters that live there. And that biodiversity is great, not just because we like species, but because biodiversity does things. It provides services that we need, right? And when you eliminate that biodiversity, what ends up happening is that you have to replace it. You have to replace it usually with an agrochemical of some sort. And that works for a while. But right now, a lot of our rangelands and a lot of our farmland in general is kind of hitting a wall with what we can produce. Like Peter said, we can't be raising our food. The livestock in that system is so important in terms of keeping that ecosystem moving. It's a valuable tool. We're trying to learn as quickly as we can to make these systems that the farmers are adopting into something that can be transferred and scaled across the country.
This is the initial stages of the research, Jonathan. What are you hoping specifically to learn or to show?
What's so unique about this project is the fact that there are 16 different disciplines that are on board. We're going to be able to do transformative science where we're linking different disciplines that have never been applied to the same system before. We're going to be able to link biodiversity, be it microbes, be it insect function, all the way to rancher well-being, to carbon sequestration, to landscape level effects. That's really exciting stuff. Really innovative, really important in exacting change to our food system.
Peter, when we think about that, all of these people that you've convened, you're a documentary filmmaker, but as I said at the beginning, you teach documentary filmmaking, you teach in the sustainability school at ASU as well as in journalism. As Jonathan's describing the scope of this, how did you end up involved with all of this, being the team leader of this?
When we made Carbon Nation, that's a film about solutions to climate change. And the solution that kept coming up in our research and in our filming was the soils. And in the soil specifically, the grazing of the soils. And so as I'm looking for ways that we can draw down more carbon than we're emitting, it became a clear path for me to look at that. So when we made Soil Carbon Cowboys, the short film that you've been playing clips of in 2013, I started the research and I started finding the scientists who are working on the pieces of this puzzle. Like, we've got the folks looking at the greenhouse gases. You know, what's happening with the methane? Do you have methanotrophic bacteria that love to eat methane? And so the methane question about the animals is a big one, but how much methane are they emitting when the whole system is also sucking up methane? What's that balance? Are the animals doing well? Is the plant forage productive? And all these pieces of the puzzle came together, and it was just a vacuum of need. And I'd just been hired by ASU, which is an incredibly innovative university, and they let this filmmaker start this science project. And I started bringing in funding and really good scientists, and it just sort of happened. It's the same skill set as making a movie, and I have a great passion for this solution. Our soils are in really, really bad shape. I'm more worried about our soils than I am about climate change, and I'm really worried about climate change. But these farmers are healing their soils so quickly, and these ranchers, that I want to give them the biggest platform. I want to give our science team the best way to measure these things so we can communicate this information, because I think this is a huge opportunity to do so many good things.
That's Peter Bick. He is a documentary filmmaker. He's the director producer of Soil Carbon Cowboys, which is the short film that we've been talking about here. I want to thank Jonathan Lundgren for being with us as well, with the Ichthysis Foundation. Jonathan, Peter, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual book, jacket, and journal show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, November 5th through the 16th. University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I am innocent. I've been found guilty. I know that. Most people think I'm guilty. But the fact remains, I'm as innocent now as I was before I was arrested. I was a nurturing father, a gentle husband, an above-average provider, a helpful church-going religious man, a productive member of society.
That was the voice of David Hendricks in 1986, a press conference he gave from the Menard Correctional Facility. Those around, especially in Bloomington and Peoria, will remember the Hendricks family murders. Susan Hendricks and her three children, Rebecca, Grace, and Benjamin, brutally murdered in their homes 35 years ago this week. The horrific crime and its aftermath rocked central Illinois. Reasonable Doubt is journalist Steve Vogel's account of the crime, the trial, and the eventual acquittal of David Hendricks. It was first released in 1989. A year later, it hit the New York Times bestseller list. It's been re-released several times, but on this anniversary, Steve has released the book again, and he's in studio with me now in Urbana. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So it's 35 years ago. Why the re-release now?
Well, the truth is, the book had been out of print for several years, and I was thinking about doing an e-book for posterity's sake. Then a national TV show came calling. The Investigation Discovery Network decided to do an hour-long revisit of the story, and I was thinking, well, maybe I should update the book. So now it's been released not just as a e-book, but also as a print book, and only recently came out as an audiobook.
And so for those not familiar with the story, I wonder if we can go back to the details of it. First, I was just going to ask you what you remember about that first day. And there's actually an anecdote of how you start the book when you spoke with Susan's mother. But as a reporter covering that, how vividly do you remember that first day?
Very, very well. It was a long day in broadcasting because it was an election day. I had gone to home to bed. Had slept maybe 2 or 3 hours. We got a call from the radio station saying, we have a multiple death situation not far from where you live. Could you check it out? And, of course, I went over there thinking it'd be something like a natural gas leak or something like that, to find out to her horror that a young mother and her three children were dead in their beds, brutally slain. The apparent murder weapons, an axe and a butcher knife, were found on one of the beds. And I was there, of course, for hours. And I did talk to Nadine Palmer, who was the mother of the young mother and the mother-in-law of the man who eventually was charged, convicted, then acquitted of the crimes.
It's a really horrific, gruesome details of how they were killed. And did people know that right away in the Bloomington area? You write about this, about how scared people were, about how people started locking their doors and how the locksmiths were busy for days.
People did not know many of the details early on. In fact, it was almost a year before the trial began, a 9-week-long trial that was held on a change of venue in Rockford. And it was only then that the full details came out. Up until then, there were rumors, over-the-top rumors, about some type of religious fanatic and the crime scene and things like that, most of which were not true. It was bad enough as it was. But there was a lot of imagination put to the story in the months that preceded the trial because both the prosecution and the defense were very tight-lipped about it.
But this was a national news story when it happened.
It was, yeah. 4 people found dead in their beds. And then it continued in the news because, of course, there was interest in who might be charged. And a month later, the father, you know, a father of 3, was accused of killing 4 people.
And that's David Hendricks. He said he was out of town at the time of the murders. Was he immediately a suspect?
Yes, almost immediately. In fact, the chief investigator came out of his very first interview with Hendricks at a neighbor's home and said he's dirty. That was the term he used. So he was the chief suspect from the first hours. And there were other people looked into. There were some lie detector tests given and the like, but he was the central focus. And that became the subject of controversy after the fact, whether or not police too quickly focused on the single suspect.
And so one part of this, and you alluded to this a little, was the family's religious beliefs. They're part of a Christian sect called the Plymouth Brethren, very conservative in the sense of not celebrating Christmas, which they say has no biblical authorization, no television, no radio. What else did we know about the family's religious practice at the time? Because this ends up becoming an important part of the trial.
Indeed. The Brethren are almost a primitive Christian group. No ordained clergy, usually no churches. They might have a meeting house. And I don't know if it's still true or not, but at this time, women were not allowed to speak at the services.
And this is in 1983.
Yeah. Hendricks had become, and this is a little bit at odds with the religion in a way, he'd become very successful financially with his—
A very successful businessman.
Invention of a back brace, but he was also generous with his money. He was one of the leaders of the religious group, and that became central to the prosecution. The state believed that he had become bored with his marriage and wanted out, but divorce was forbidden in the Brethren except in the case of adultery.
And so that ended up being a central part of this. When David Hendricks ends up on trial, I wonder how much was known about his business practice and his religion. Was it fair to say that he led a double life?
Police discovered that Hendricks had made some rather awkward, most people would say pretty juvenile, sexual advances on some young women that he had hired to model his brace at trade shows and in some brochures.
The hindsight of reading this book in 2018... reading the parts of the trial where he's describing the interactions he had with the models. In the world of Me Too now was very clearly sexual harassment or sexual assault. Like, at best, sexual harassment, probably sexual assault. The way that we think about these incidents now.
Agreed.
That was fascinating to me because, and he, to this day, he says he feels like, I apologize for that behavior, but that doesn't mean I killed my wife.
That's right.
And my kids.
I mean, they were awkward, stupid things he was doing. But what does that have to do with whether or not he killed his wife or and children? Police think it had a lot to do with it, that he was onto a different, wilder lifestyle because he had money and was tired of his wife. But I think that's a stretch. essentially, the police believed that Hendricks' only way out of his marriage in a way that could maintain his reputation within his large family, both his side of the family and his wife's side of the family, and with his church, was to kill his wife, and in order to shift suspicion away from him, to also kill his three children.
I mean, that just when you say that, that just sounds so crazy.
Well, a lot of people thought so. I mean, that's one of the interesting things to me about it. As I indicated, Hendricks had a lot of brothers and sisters. So did Susan, his wife, and his parents, her parents. Every one of them stood behind David Hendricks. They could not see him as someone who would do such a thing.
And so did her family stand by him as well, even after his conviction?
Always.
And to this day?
Yes. One of the things that was first reported in the book, and it's kind of interesting, is how on the trial eve, the chief prosecutor, Ron Dozier, had a face-to-face meeting with David Hendricks.
Mm.
And Dozier went into that meeting hoping to get Hendricks to cop a plea, that Dozier was putting on the table, you plead guilty and I will not seek the death penalty. Dozier left that meeting pretty convinced he had the wrong guy.
But the trial went ahead.
It did. Actually, there was then a short delay in the trial, and his assistant and the chief investigator convinced him to move ahead with the trial.
I wonder if you can take us through the events of the trial. Where was the trial held?
Trial was held in Rockford, change of venue. The evidence against Hendricks was all circumstantial. There were no fingerprints, footprints in a very bloody crime scene. A big part of the prosecution's case was based on expert opinions about when exactly the murders occurred. Hendricks had left for a business trip late the night of the murders. Prosecution experts testified scientific evidence indicated the murders occurred before Hendricks departed for his trip. There were also defense experts who testified that the time of death was at best uncertain and that the killings could easily have occurred sometime after Hendricks left the house.
And so the science of this was interesting, right? Because a lot of this was analysis of food that was found in the children. I wonder now, I mean, if we think about 35 years ago, what the science, forensic science was like, I imagine this case would have been tried a completely different way had this happened.
Great question, particularly DNA evidence and the evidence.
Because they looked for things, but I wonder what the level of sophistication of technology was 35 years
clearly,
ago.
Clearly it would have been a different case.
So I think the interesting part about this is David Hendricks is found guilty of murder.
The first vote by the jury, by the way, was 6-6.
Wow. But then they do eventually agree that he's guilty.
Yes. Yeah. And the prosecution seeks the death penalty, and the judge imposes a sentence of natural life in prison instead.
But there's an interesting line about that, what the judge says during that first trial in which the judge talks about whether or not a reasonable doubt exists.
Yeah, in the sentencing order, Judge Richard Boehner essentially said that as far as he was concerned, the prosecution's case against Hendricks had not been strong enough, had not reached a level of reasonable doubt that allowed him as a judge to impose a death sentence.
And that eventually then there's an appeal?
Went to an appeals court first where it was upheld 3-0. And then it went to the Illinois Supreme Court. Hendricks had been in prison about 5 years about that time. And in late 1988, the Supreme Court upheld the verdict on a vote of 4-2.
And then?
And then about a year later, the Supreme Court said it was going to reconsider the case. There was a hearing, and in July of 1990, the Supreme Court overturned the verdict and the sentence, told the prosecutors they could either retry him or let him go. The prosecution decided to retry him. It lasted more than 7 weeks, and the jury found Hendricks not guilty after deliberating for about 10 hours.
And to this day, so David Hendricks has since remarried, in fact, several times, and to this day has a successful business in Florida.
He does. He lives in Orlando. He and his wife, Gazelle, have been married for 16 years.
And she read your book.
Yes, she did. That's what Hendricks tells me she has, yeah.
Have you talked to him since especially now that the book, as you said, was out of print and has now been re-released? Did you have discussions with him?
Oh, I did. He cooperated in my updating the book. And I was getting a lot of questions from people, you know, what's happened to Hendricks since he was released and that type of thing. And the story is interesting. Gazelle is his fourth wife. She is 25 years younger than he is. They recently, I mean, they got two very young children.
I wonder, and I bet people have asked you about this a lot, Steve. So when this book came out, when we think about the whole true crime genre, this book is often mentioned within that. Why do you think people get so interested in these stories?
I think there are a lot of reasons. One is, and this doesn't speak too well of the human race, I think, but I think it's a little bit like there, but for the grace of God go I. It's a little bit like driving past a bad car wreck. You don't want to look, but you can. These stories tell a lot about human nature. I mean, I think this book is as good as any in proving that sometimes truth is a lot more interesting than fiction. If I had written this as a novel, people would say, no, that doesn't happen. That's not believable. But some strange things did happen.
To this day, nobody really knows the truth of what happened with this story.
No, I don't know that we ever will. It might take a deathbed confession. In the second trial, the defense wanted to present evidence that it believed would point the finger of guilt at a former brother-in-law, a man who had married Susan Hendricks' sister. It never got that information in front of the jury, but Hendricks believes that he may very well be the true
killer.
To this
day, that's what he believes.
Yeah, but he also really hasn't pursued it, which a lot of people are suspicious of, you know. And he basically says, as a private individual, you can only go so far in investigating. You don't have a power of subpoena. You can't threaten people with prosecution. It's just probably an ignoble end to the story.
Steve, how has the way you've thought about this changed over the past three decades, this story, coming back to it now?
Well, as I wrote in the original book, and of course it's contained in the update of Reasonable Doubt, I've never believed that if I had been in the first jury that I would have been able to convict him. I think I would have been a holdout. I don't think the state proved him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, of course, the question of innocence is a separate question. The first one's a legal question. The other one is whether he did it or not. But over the years, I've come more and more to believe that he probably did not commit the crime. Part of it is, I think, the motive was pretty thin. Part of it was just in having face-to-face discussions with him. People seem to agree with me who believe in him, that if he were your next-door neighbor, you'd think he was a great guy. He's bright. He's got a good sense of humor. Obviously, nothing awful has happened in the intervening years in terms of psychotic episodes or violence. But more importantly than anything is what we talked about earlier, and that is that to a person, all of his relatives, his wife's side of the family and his side of the family, never believed he was guilty.
The details of all of this are in Reasonable Doubt, which, as Steve Vogel has been telling us, has just been re-released. If you're in the Bloomington area, Steve's going to be speaking about this at 7 o'clock on Thursday at the Bloomington Public Library. Steve, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, Illinois was once a national leader at helping students afford to go to college, but we've fallen behind in recent decades, and it's one reason why we now have one of the biggest graduation gaps when it comes to African American and Latino students and their white college student counterparts. When we come back, we'll dive into what Illinois colleges are pledging to do about this problem. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's the time of year when many students are applying to college, but as hard as it can be to get in, finishing college is also a big challenge. And that can be different depending on your racial background. Across the country, Black and Latino students graduate from college at a much lower rate than their white counterparts. And in Illinois, we have the fourth largest gap. 66% of white students graduate college within 6 years, compared to 33% for African Americans and 48% for Latinos. Recently, a group of colleges have come together and agreed they need to solve this problem in the coming years and close those gaps. Kyle Westbrook is leading this initiative. It's called the Illinois Equity and Attainment Initiative. He's also executive director of the Partnership for College Completion based in Chicago. Hi, Kyle. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, how are you, Nyla? Thank you for having me.
So I mentioned some of those numbers. Thanks for being here. I mentioned some of those numbers just now, and we're going to dig into the solutions in a minute. But I just wanted to start with different challenges students face, because when someone gets an acceptance letter, it's a very happy moment for them and their family because it's a sign of a brighter future. But if you are lower income, or predominantly if you are Black or Latino, how is that path forward potentially more difficult?
There are a number of complicating factors that mean that, you know, college graduation rates, as you mentioned, are substantially lower for African-American students and Latino students than white students. And that initial excitement that students feel when they get that acceptance letter is very often tempered by another reality that comes shortly after that acceptance letter, which is the financial obligations that students are going to have to meet in order to enroll in college. And we know that not just in Illinois, but really across the country, the purchasing power of the available financial aid has been decreasing over time. And we know that on exit surveys of students who did not complete college or withdrew or stopped out, finance tends to be the number one or the most frequently cited reason that students don't complete. But we also know that beyond finance, there are issues in terms of student advising. Are students actually getting the advice and counsel on the proper courses that they need to take in a timely manner? Are transfer credits actually transferring and applying towards their degrees if they're transferring from a 2 to a 4-year university? So it can be really a wide variety of factors. And when you consider that African-American students and Latino students are much more likely than white students to enroll in community colleges, we know that issues around transfer can be a substantial barrier for students, not just in whether they complete, but even when they do, the time to completion or the time to actually completing their degree. And so these are just a number of the multitude of issues that this group of colleges, universities will undertake in partnership, not only with us, but with each other, to understand what can they do to begin to close those gaps, which have been persistent for the last 30 years.
Obviously, we hear politicians and lawmakers talk about higher education in Illinois a lot, especially this campaign season. I want to get back to some of the other things you mentioned about non-financial issues, but let me just start with the financial issues, because I think there probably are people listening right now who remember a time where they were able to work their way through college with perhaps even a part-time job. I know I did that. How different is the cost of college in 2018? Yeah, you're laughing.
No, I am, because I was that student also. I'm not going to date myself too much, but in the early 90s, Illinois in particular was really regarded as the national leader in terms of aid to students and the ability for a low-income student like myself to attend. I went to graduated from SIU Carbondale, and I went to Carbondale virtually free. When you combined my federal Pell aid, my federal SEOG, and the Illinois Student Assistance MAP Award, my bill at SIU Carbondale for room and board and tuition would be basically covered. And so my part-time job was allowing me living money and making sure that I had money to pay my bills on a day-to-day basis. And unfortunately, in Illinois, those days are over. The last time the MAP Award, which through the 90s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, it covered the full cost of tuition at any of our public universities. So since 2002, the state funding for the MAP Award has remained virtually flat as tuition and fees have gone up. So 2002, the MAP Award covered the full cost of tuition for a low-income student. Now it only covers about a third. For low-income students, there's often a significant gap between what their aid will fund and what the cost of attendance are that in many cases just cannot be made up for through part-time employment. And so we obviously see students increasingly turning to student loans as a way to fund their education. In Illinois last year, 61% of the college graduates in the class of 2017 graduated with debt, which is a little bit beneath the national average, but still very troubling nonetheless. And the default rates for African-American students in particular are almost double what they are for white students.
So, Kyle, when we're thinking about this gap, when I mentioned how much Illinois has the fourth largest gap when it comes to Black and Latino college students compared to their white counterparts in terms of graduation, do you think a lot of that does have to do with the finances and how much aid is being offered?
Some of that has to do with finances. There's no doubt that low-income students, and we know African-American students are disproportionately low-income, or they overrepresent in the low-income student population in Illinois. There's no doubt that finance, and it's one of the things that you hear not only from students, but you also hear from university leaders themselves, is the number of students, for instance, who are on campus who are experiencing housing insecurity or food insecurity, yet and still are trying to do their best to make it to class every day. But we also think about what are the moves that, or the things that the institutions themselves can do that could, for instance, improve the way that students are advised. When you look at some of the institutions around the country that have closed their equity gaps, one of the most important levers has been to really think about and invest in not only the number of advisors that students have access to on campus, but what that advising actually looks like. And so, you know, we don't think that finance alone is going to solve the completion gap, because if that were the case, then we would not have had a completion gap through the 1990s and early 2000s when Illinois was a very well-funded higher education system. We know that there are a number of obviously sort of institutional practices that colleges, universities themselves can take control over and implement on their campuses that can begin to make an impact on closing those achievement gaps, which are persistent and, you know, in many cases mirror gaps in K-12, but we would argue that those gaps in college completion become, they're compounded in their importance because of the degree to which students are often taking out those student loans and then will be shouldered with tens of thousands of dollars of debt if they don't complete their degree. And so these gaps aren't unique to higher education, but we feel that, you know, in higher education increasingly feels that they have a unique opportunity and a unique role to play in closing those gaps, which have been so persistent.
Kyle, earlier this fall, you launched the Illinois Equity and Attainment Initiative, which includes 25 colleges in Illinois. Have these colleges signed on to do things like advising and the other things you were just mentioning?
The first year of the initiative is our team will lead the colleges and universities through a year-long strategic planning process, because one of the things we firmly believe is that there are no one-size-fits-all approaches to how to close these achievement gaps. So, for instance, on many of our most selective college and university campuses, one of the challenges that students often face and this is true of many of our less selective, but our more selective and private colleges often have the resources to be able to solve this challenge, is where students need small kind of micro grants or $400 or $500 that in many cases might be fines from the library or might be fees or things like that that they weren't able to pay, that often can become a barrier to students re-enrolling. And so some of our selective college universities say, well, they have the resources to put together these small emergency fund opportunities for students to apply and get the kind of just-in-kind funds that they need in order to pay their library fines or parking fines, et cetera, which is an entirely different solution from a two-year community college that has some significant challenges around remediation and the numbers of students that come in need of developmental education in math or reading. And so we are not prescribing to the colleges, universities, what their approaches should be, but we'll lead them through a process where senior leaders on those campuses and along with our staff and along with each other will pull together data on their institutions to begin to identify what those challenges are, but then also then develop solutions.
Kyle, we just have a few minutes left, so I'm hoping you can quickly answer the next couple of questions that I wanted to ask.
Sure.
So if this includes, so Kyle, this includes 25 colleges in Illinois. What colleges are a part of this?
Sure, there are 25 colleges, 13 community colleges, 12 four-year college universities, including five of our state public universities, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, University of Illinois at Chicago, Northeastern Illinois University, Northern Illinois University, Governor State, as well as some private colleges like DePaul, as well as all seven of the city colleges of Chicago and Oakton Community College in the suburbs of Chicago, Morton Community College, College of Lake County. So most of the 25 college universities are in the Chicago area, but the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Blackburn College, a small work college in central Illinois, is also a part of this cohort.
And as you said, you're going to be gathering data, working with them. What would you like the first year to look like?
So at the end of this first year, we hope every institution will have, by June of 2019, will have an equity plan. And that is really a roadmap for how they will close their equity gaps over the next 6 years. And that equity plan will not only say what those institutions should be investing in, but also what kinds of supports and what kinds of policies our state should also be pursuing to support increasing graduation rates. And so we think that the public policy aspect of this work is also important to advancing it and making sure that the institutions have not only the resources, but the support from our elected officials in implementing the kinds of strategies and the kinds of approaches to close those equity gaps.
And Kyle, I wonder how much, just one last question for you, as you're thinking particularly about Black and Latino students, but I'm thinking this is a problem of lots of young people these days. How important is it to get a message out there that college is still a path to economic mobility, given the amount of debt that we're seeing students face?
It is. It's critical. You know, one of the things that, and though we're based in Chicago, we spend a fair amount of time meeting with not only legislators, but also colleges, universities around the state. And I'll say that one of the things that a number of university leaders have expressed to us is a malaise that they see and hear amongst young people who feel that college is increasingly out of reach for them, particularly low-income students. And that malaise transcends race, and that malaise often transcends geography. And so one of the things that we know is so critical is the role that our high school guidance counselors play in not only the application and the selection process, but also the application and getting the word out to students that college is a viable option for them, and that not only is it a viable option for them, but that increasingly in this new economy, a college degree or advanced certificate is going to be really their only path towards a family-sustaining income. And so we have to continue to stress to our students that whether it is a certificate from a community college or whether it's a four-year degree, college has to be a part of what your post-secondary aspirations are, or college or the military or some type of advanced training has to be a part of how you're thinking about your tomorrow. And our college guidance counselors in high schools are critical to that work, and they need all of our support in order to actually do that.
That's Kyle Westbrook. He is the executive director of the Partnership for College Completion. He's also leading this initiative we've been talking about, the Illinois Equity and Attainment Initiative, hoping to close these gaps that we've been talking about, Illinois having the fourth largest in the country between Black and Latino students and their white college counterparts when it comes to college graduation. Kyle, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. If you haven't yet, do not forget to get out there and vote. If you still haven't registered, you can cast your ballot. Just make sure to bring two forms of ID. One needs to have your current address if you haven't registered. And tune into this NPR station tonight for special coverage of the midterm election results. We'll be having national NPR coverage of what's happening across the country, and I'll be hosting live coverage focusing specifically on Illinois. All of that begins tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll be breaking in when we have news of who our next governor will be and let you know as soon as we do the results of our local congressional races. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here at 7 o'clock tonight.